Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony. And for this episode this week, we will travel back in time to one of the panels that I had the privilege of attending at this year's Fan Expo Canada 2019, which featured quite a lineup of creators, namely Michael T. Gilbert, Ty Templeton, and Klaus Janson, indeed titans of the industry. And it was hosted by comic historian Blake Bell. And the topic of the panel was a retroactive look at the careers of Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and Steve Ditko. And what I enjoyed about this panel is the timelessness of it. Most of us never had the chance, or at this point will never have the chance, to sit and hear legends like Ditko, Lee, or Kirby really talk about their years when they were in their creative heyday, at least at a comic book convention. Maybe you have footage on the internet, or maybe some old video footage that you can find on YouTube, of course. There's plenty of that. But for me, I didn't get to hear Stan Lee until, you know, after the Hollywood years had begun. So you were, of course, in these huge lineups. It was very difficult to get to him. Blase, blase. But this panel in particular, with these particular gentlemen, was very candid, very insightful, very authentic. It was interesting to hear stories about these guys, the interactions that they had with the men themselves, as well as how they interacted with their work. I didn't grow up in the era when this work was on the newsstands or on the spinner racks, so my interpretations of it are very much affected by the legends of what they are and how they came to influence people who came after them. So I personally find it helpful hearing about their interpretation, understanding what was happening behind the scenes during the times that their careers overlapped within the Marvel offices, or even in the DC offices for that matter. So I enjoyed this episode very much. I really wanted to share it with the fans of those who love comic book history. And in this case, we can never get enough goodness when it comes to listening to these three gentlemen who basically are the crux of the Marvel universe as we know it, and in many cases affected the DC universe, in the case of Jack Kirby creating the Fourth World. So without further ado, this is the panel from this year's Fan Expo Canada, featuring Michael T. Gilbert, Ty Templeton, and Klaus Janson, remembering the careers of Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and Steve Ditko. Enjoy the show, everybody.
I'm the writer of various books on the Marvel Universe. I wrote Strange and Stranger with Steve Ditko back in 2008. If you Bill Everett books, thank you very much. I appreciate that. That'll get me going through the next year. The Secret History of Marvel Comics, Jack Kirby and all the moonlighting artists. Such and that nature, and I also, my very first book was I Have to Live with This Guy from 2001, from Tomorrow's, where I interviewed all the wives and spouses of famous cartoonists, including Stan Lee and his wife back in the day. So thank you very much all for coming here. We've got an esteemed panel of people here who met and associated with the three gentlemen in question, plus just great artists that we have here who could talk to the impact of the three gentlemen in question's work, and also the influence on their lives. So sitting to my direct right, we have a gentleman who has worked throughout many of the companies and the industries. He certainly started back in, what was it, 1972 when you published your first, was it Platts? What was the
New Pulse Comics. It was my university, New Pulse Comics. I self-published it, and it was 1973.
So this gentleman's been around. Of course, you know him very well for his work on Mr. Monster and all the associated work that he's really done with fandom. Please welcome Michael T. Gilbert. So to Michael's, and by the way, Michael and I shared a hotel room back in San Diego Comic-Con in 2002, but don't tell anybody. We'll get into that later. Anybody wants to stay around later at the bar, we'll get into stories like that. Sitting to his right is a fellow Canadian writer, artist. He's been around as long as I've been around at these Comic-Con shows. And they've all worked for everybody, so just going on, but
I've
of course...
never drawn Daredevil.
He's never drawn Daredevil.
That's
all right,
I haven't yet.
That's his bucket list. So, but he also does is an excellent teacher and scholar running. And forgive me, is it still Ty Templeton's comic book boot camp?
Ty Templeton's comic book boot camp. We're literally moving locations as soon as I get out of this building tonight. I'm picking boxes and moving. So,
well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, Ty Templeton.
To his direct right, of course, is one of my favorite professionals over the last 30, 40 years, going as far back, of course, as working as an assistant to Dick Giordano in the early 70s. And of course, you correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong. I believe your first was it Jungle Action, I believe, was your very first published work back in the 1970s. And then, of course, working prominently with Sal Buscema as an inker as well on The Defenders. And of course, very famously known of through the work on Daredevil with Frank Miller back in the 80s. I could go on and on and on, but please welcome Klaus Janson here. Geez, when I first met you guys back in 2001, I think the X-Men had just come out, but that was it. We had no concept that there was going to be that this transition from the Marvel comic books to the Marvel universe, the Marvel film universe as well, right? Even back in the 80s when we were running around doing our thing, the ability to even put that type of work from a CGI perspective, from an effects perspective, or from a studio perspective was very nascent back in those days. Can you guys tell me your memories of comic book on film or TV and what your dreams and aspirations for it were at the time as you were watching?
Well, I'm exactly the right age that I was 5 years old when Adam West was on television. So I suspect a big part of my fondness for superheroes is that Adam West and the world was focused on him in the 60s. And being five, I just got to go, that! I'll be doing that! Because I suspected Batman and Robin was that was a job possibility. And, not to draw them, but to fight crime. And probably never considered that I wasn't at some point going to end up becoming some version of Batman. And since I've gotten to write him and draw him, that means I'm putting words in his mouth and making him jump off buildings. I sort of became Batman.
All right. Klaus, how about yourself back then, especially in the 70s? The early Spider-Man TV shows and things of that nature. It didn't hold out a lot of hope or promise at the time, did it?
Nicholas Hammond was a star.
You know, obviously at that time I was influenced by Adam West, as Ty would say, and the Batman TV show. But I never thought, and guys, check me on this, but I never thought that it would go really beyond that. And I never was able to see the Marvel universe as it is now, which is, and I hesitate to say this, but I suspect that more people have seen the movies than have read the comics. And
by legions.
And I find that to be just absolutely amazing. The difference between the movies and the comics for me is that I have nothing to do with the movies. And I am able to control and draw and contribute to the comics, and that still remains my first love. To be able to do that is an amazing opportunity, and I'm grateful for it really every day. It's a great job, it's a great industry, it's a great way of expressing yourself, it's a great way to be able to tell a story. It's really, it's a great life.
Michael, what was from your perspective in university in the early 70s and then working as a professional?
Well, even before that, the first thing that really got me was seeing the Superman TV show in the 50s, and I was a kid, and I was just enthralled by it. That's what sort of got me into comics in the first place, and where I got my first Jimmy Olsen comic at that point, and I saw this guy was on TV, and wonderful. And by the 70s, the one that really hit me today was the Superman movie from 1978. Really high hopes for that movie as a superhero thing, and it really lived up to it, which was impressive. Now, of course, I'm just really impressed with all the various Marvel movies that they've come out with in the last 20 years. I think they've done a remarkable job that's true to the spirit of Stan and Jack and Steve Ditko. The thing that always gets me when I think about this stuff, thinking about your latest Thor or whatever it is, and I'm realizing, they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to do this, and Jack Kirby and these guys were sitting in their little basement getting $50 a page and doing it first. They were able to do it in that little thing here. It takes these guys, a zillion people and a zillion dollars to recreate the feeling that they were able to do just by themselves.
But the reason it feels good is because they are not trying to reinvent Jack, but to actually give us Jack.
Right, the spirit.
The thing that made me so happy when I was watching the Thor Ragnarok film was that I was seeing Jack Kirby's design work on the screen. That they weren't looking at it going, "Ah, we can fix this." They were looking at it going, "Oh, we should honor this." And that gave me little happy tingles in special places. spider tingles, yeah.
Yes.
Peter tingles.
Yes.
Yeah, so I wanted to mention this because you're talking about movies. A couple of, about 2 years ago, my son, who was at the time 21, he comes to me and he goes, "You know, I don't really know anything about Superman." In my family, that's a bit of a crime, but he didn't really know much about Superman. And he goes, "Where should I start? Like, should I read the Alan Moore Superman comics? Should I read the Kurt Swan, Len Wein ones or something? What should I do?" And so I said, "Well, a good place to start is the Chris Reed movie, because it's a good place to get the spirit of it." And I hadn't seen it in a couple of years, so I thought, "I'll sit down and I will watch it with you." And this is a 20-year-old kid who's grown up playing Red Dead Redemption and, every video game in the world, and he's used to the modern culture of things. And I thought the movie was going to be a little slow for him because it was made in the 70s, and there's a lot of farm machinery in the early 90s. There's a lot. People in fields going, "Fields, farms." It's pretty slow. And we watched it somewhat in silence, and when the film was over, he turned to me and he said, "I didn't know they made perfect films." And he was tearing up a little bit about how good the movie was. And then I got to say to him, "You get to see part two." He didn't know there was a second part. And we have a man crush on Chris Reed together, and this is the way we got it. No, we do. And to me, the idea of how good that film was meant that I could intergenerationally share it with my kid, and he didn't need to see incredible CGI and all this other stuff, because if you get the heart of the story right, if you get the things that matter correct, It's a beautiful thing when you do it right. I always say that Superman's superpower is not that he can fly or lift trucks, but that his heart beats better than yours and mine does. And I think Christopher Reeve called that beautifully when he did it. And I like the idea that you can share that with somebody who's in their 20s now.
It's ironic, because I was born in 1970, so I went through the phase of the Spider-Man cartoons that mimicked the Steve Ditko style and those original stories. And I went through Batman. That was like cultural wallpaper, but when the Spider-Man TV show came out, the Nicholas Hammond show, I think it was the late 70s, we were really disappointed, because, and we also had that, TV and movies were really coming into the cultural forefront. Video was coming in through MTV. So we had a stake in wanting to see comic books come out of their little enclave and join that cultural revolution. So when you would see all these superheroes, this terrible work of supervillains and superheroes, even the first Superman movie, I was like, "Well, it's just Lex Luthor, a regular guy. I want to see somebody bashing heads with Superman." So when the second Superman came out, he had Zod, and these guys were flying, and these guys were knocking each other out. I thought that was more interesting, because I wanted to see the Ditko Doctor Strange effects and the things that happened in the X-Men and the Spider-Man movies. That's what I think part of my generation was looking for, to step into that world of that realism that we were lacking in the Spider-Man TV show.
They just announced that they're making a New Gods movie. I don't want it. I really don't want it, because I want New Gods to be ours. I want it to be secret and a little special handshake that only those of us in the room can do. And that if your aunt Bertha knows who the New Gods are, that's horrifying. I nothing against your Aunt Bertha. She's a lovely woman. She makes a great crumb cake. But I don't want her knowing who Light Ray and Orion are, because I don't need to hear her opinion about them over Christmas, which is what I'm going to hear. I've got relatives who don't know anything about comics, and every now and then they go, "Let me talk to you about this Thanos fellow." It freaks me out that my grandmother would know who Thanos was. I want to keep the New Gods to myself. Big Bart is there. No one gets her but us.
And just to know it, we're here really, the Marvel Universe is fantastic, but it was really at its core, for the most part, because we don't want to discount or dismiss others who contributed to it, it was for the most part brought together by these three gentlemen. Stan Lee, just for people who may or may not know in the room, because to your point, Ty, my son was 19, so again, hasn't looked at a comic book in 1,000 years, but knows the video games and the movies, and that was his growing up, right? Stan Lee was really Stan Lieber, right? He got into Marvel Comics in 1940 through an association, through a an uncle-in-law, Martin Goodman. And Martin Goodman had started up Marvel Comics and the variation of Marvel Comics publishing, pulps, and magazines
and
in the early
30s. What was Stan's job? Getting sandwiches and sharpening pencil. That's how he starts in the business.
Right, so you think about this guy who put aside all the politics that existed between the three gentlemen. He had some fanciful notions of writing a great American novel, but he did. He came out, he got in through nepotism, right in the door of what was then just known as Marvel Comics, the first Submariner and the first Human Torch, and then rose up to became the writer and the editor-in-chief that we know. And of course, he ended up associating with Jack Kirby, Jacob Kurtzenberg, through the Joe Simon and Jack Kirby's creation of Captain America and really bringing that into the Marvel Comics fold. And then Steve Ditko, the third person, that perhaps the least known of the three, because that's the way he wanted it. He wanted the work to speak for itself. He was a second generation comic book artist, right? He followed, all these other guys were all first generations. They came from the world of let's get into advertising or let's look at the comic strips of the earlier days in the 1930s. But Steve Ditko was the first one who came in who wanted to be a comic book artist. He was the start of that generation. He didn't even show up until like 1953 and didn't show up doing a little piecemeal work for Marvel until about 1956. And then, of course, would show up in the late 50s. So, and interesting, he was from Johnstown, Pennsylvania, one of the few creators at the time who was not Jewish, right? He was, so again, he idolized all of the Will Eisners and all of those Joe Kuberts and all of those cartoonists. So that's what makes him unique and different. And then, of course, he went on to create Spider-Man and Doctor Strange and a whole host of other characters. So I just want to make sure we're all aligned. But what we're really here celebrating is the movies and this universe is the output of these three gentlemen, but it's really down to the imagination. And as we were saying up here, sitting in a small apartments or a studio in New York in anywhere from the 40s and 50s, crafting all this.
There's a fourth person that's essential to the creation of the Marvel Universe that most people don't know of. How many here know about a guy named Joe Manili? Very few, though. There's a kind of weird, sad, tragic part to his story. The reason you haven't heard about Joe Manili is he died just before the Marvel Universe got launched. And he was the go-to Marvel artist throughout the late 50s and very early 60s. And according to everyone at the time, he would have been the lead artist on all of the stuff that was given to Jack Kirby. But he fell off a train. He was on a commuter train. He fell off and died. And within 2 weeks, Jack Kirby got hired to replace him. And so if Manili had not passed away, we may never have gotten the Marvel Universe that we got, because I don't know that Joe Manili's Hulk would have had the same power. I don't know that Joe Manili's Thor would have lasted, 40, 50 years as it's done. And so there's a weird, I mean, I'd hate to say it, because Joe Manili was a phenomenal artist, but there's a weird confluence of events that he kind of had to get out of the way to start the Marvel Universe, as creepy and horrible as that is to consider, because I'm sure to his family that's a terrible thing to say. But and if you ever look up his work, for those who are familiar with it, he was phenomenal. He was really good.
Really fast, too.
Yeah, he was really fast. Yeah, and he's not particularly well remembered because mostly what he did were westerns and romance comics and science fiction and stuff like that. The only series character he ever did was called the Black Knight. And the Black Knight reprints by Manili are phenomenal, but that's not enough for a career to last, decades after he passes away. But I just wanted you guys to be aware of Joe Manili, because he is sadly part of the main part of what made Marvel what it is, was Joe Manili accidentally not being there.
And the irony is that the Marvel Universe existed because Stan Lee, at that point in the late 50s, Marvel was on its last breath.
Holding up the chairs.
Yeah. And Stan needed people who could pump out material fast just based on ideas that he might come up with or trust the artists to come up with themselves, because he was running the business, such as it was at the time, in with very limited resources. So he needed people who could pump the work out, and he knew that Ditko and Kirby, and unfortunately with Manili's passing, he knew that Ditko and Kirby could do that work at a breathtaking pace. And he had a couple others like Don Heck, and I'm forgetting who might be some others. I mean,
John Romita was there by then. He was doing the romance and the westerns, but he was there.
Right.
So, we forget that Marvel had romance and western books as a main source of their schedule. If you go back to the late 50s, early 60s, about a third of their books were Westerns and about a third of them were romance books. They didn't have that many science fiction and superhero comics for a while, which is why they turned the science fiction books into the comic books. Tales to Astonish and Suspense became superhero books because they originally started as science fiction stuff. But they were still doing Gunsmoke Western and Two Gun Kid and all that other stuff as the Marvel Universe was exploding, and Romita was doing those.
Yeah, and that was the start of the Marvel Universe, was all these monster books and sci-fi books that were popular at the time.
I think of Rawhide Kid as the start of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Because it was the first Lee Kirby series with a continuing character, was the Rawhide Kid. So I tend to think of that as ground zero. If any of you guys have ever looked at the old Lee Kirby Rawhide Kids, they're phenomenal. Because what's great about them, they're a Western, but then the Rawhide Kid would suddenly be fighting aliens and totem poles that would come to life and dragons that would hide under mountains and stuff. Did you ever read those? Oh, they're phenomenal, because they're not like Westerns. They're like, oh, damn it, we're a Marvel comic, we have to make a Western. The totem pole came to life and killed everybody.
Yeah, they would graft these genres together.
Yeah.
You know, the monsters were selling, but they were slowly getting out of the monsters, so they would put out the raw kid.
Well, Jack Kirby was the honey badger of comics. He didn't give a damn.
So, Klaus, from your perspective, when you think of the works of Kirby and Ditko, when you first saw these works or became familiar with them as creators, what jumped out at you about both of these gentlemen in terms of what made them unique and what they brought, and what they, you know, might have had an impact on your career or your work or inspiration, at least?
You know, I thought that Kirby, to me, was somebody, and, you know, it's my personal failings, I think. I never understood Kirby when I was a kid. I thought it was very difficult. It was very difficult for me to understand what Kirby was doing. Steve Ditko, on the other hand, I mean, I've grown to appreciate what Kirby did, and I think I'm starting to understand, you know, what Kirby was doing. But Steve Ditko was a big influence on me. You can't underestimate how much my work is influenced by Ditko, including his middle period at DC when he was doing The Creeper and The Hawk and Dove. I love those books. But both of those guys, Kirby and Ditko, the thing that leaped out at me, and still does, is that they were clearly identifiable in their product, that their work was very unique and individual, and their style was easily identifiable. And that was something that I carried with me and tried to do as, you know, as I'm currently still working. The specifically with Steve Ditko, his ability to create mood or weather, he always had an amazing ability to draw rain and have the rain dripping off, you know, the characters, off of Spider-Man, off of the Creeper. And that was something that I thought was very smart, because I think that a lot of artists tend to not pay attention to that because they think it's detail-y or not important. And I think that it's just as important as the characters themselves, you know, their setting, their mood, the feeling, the emotion that you get from their work. So both, to me, Kirby and Ditko were amazing artists in the sense that they were very, very unique and one of a kind. I think we probably agree on that. Very one of a kind.
Well, I was going to say, when you mentioned this, that you had a lack of an affinity for Jack when you were younger. I hated Kirby when I was a kid. Hated him. He was that guy that couldn't draw. And
that's right.
Yeah, that. But for some reason, every single comic he ever drew was my favorite comic. And I loved every page of it and every damn drawing, but he couldn't draw. And because what he did wasn't realistic, and so the tiny lizard part of my brain expected comic books should look like Kurt Swan drew them.
Right.
And when Jack Kirby drew them, as I said, they looked ugly, but oh my God, I love it, but it looks ugly. And so I had a conversation once with George Perez about this, and we were both sort of lamenting at how ugly this Jack Kirby comic was, and at the same time both going, but did you read it? Oh my God, this is a fantastic story. Everything about this was great, but it's really ugly though. But here, I gotta get it again. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s that I started going, oh, it looks like this on purpose.
this is not just a guy struggling to draw and getting it wrong. This is a genius creating his own visual language that has nothing to do with the world we see around us.
And that's part of his uniqueness, is that he was creating a visual language that was his own.
And he wasn't trying to please us. He was just trying to make it.
That's absolutely right. But, you know, one of the things that fascinated me about Kirby to this day is that, as Ty mentions, his work developed into a certain style that was not, let's say, anatomically correct or...
Everybody's kneecap was made of bread dough.
But if you look at his work from the 40s, he was much more realistic then than he turned out to be in the 60s and 70s. And you can track his evolution from the realism that he tried to draw in the 40s and 50s up to the more expressionistic, kind of cubist approach that he used. He narrowed everything down to its essential ingredient so that it was...
Almost to its essential movement.
It's all about movement. And one of the things that I found was so interesting about Kirby was that he approached the panel, whereas many of us who draw and tell stories in comics, many of us use the panel in a one-dimensional way, like a window. Kirby used it like a cube, so that it had... You can take his panels and turn them around in what is it, 8 different positions? A cube has 8 sides, is it MI6? Thank you. So you can turn it around in 6 different ways and have access to that action. So he was so far ahead of what most of us did at that time and what most of us are doing even now. So when I was younger, I couldn't understand what he was doing, and that misunderstanding or lack of ability to understand what he was doing is indicative of how far ahead he was of everybody else.
I probably read a Jack Kirby comic every day, which means I have to reread them sometimes. But when I come to conventions like this, I just go to the bins and I find old Monsters in the Prowl or old Rawhide Kids or something, and I take them home. And every time I read a Jack Kirby comic, I am impressed with how he was always ahead of the game. That no matter when he was doing it, he was ahead of the curve. And, I mean, if you look at something like Captain Victory, which is the last major project that he did in the 80s, if you guys aren't familiar with it, it was a Pacific comic. It was one of the first creator-owned comics ever done. And Captain Victory, when you read it, when I read it as a late teenager, I thought it was just this fairly simple story about galactic spacemen. And I reread it fairly recently, and oh my God, it's just King Lear. And he's retelling a Shakespearean story in what just seems to be guys with zap guns and aliens. And how dare he do that to me when I was, 18 and wasn't aware I was reading King Lear.
I think to some degree, I was talking to a writer a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him, why do you work as much as you do? And because he was telling me that he wakes up at 2 or 3 in the morning and he starts writing because he can't stop. And I think Kirby was like that. He couldn't stop creating. He couldn't stop coming up with ideas. He was unique in that way. Just an incredible amount of creativity and output. And I suspect he really couldn't stop. He couldn't stop himself.
I had a feeling, did you ever talk to him much?
Not much, no.
I had a feeling whenever I talked to him that he had trouble with English language. And I don't mean this to be flippant or glib, but he didn't form sentences very well. They tended to trail off. He tended to change his subject in the middle and stare out the window and look at a bird. He really did not have language. And I've always felt that it was because his brain was so visual, language was almost beneath him.
And so if
while you were talking to Jack, if he had a pencil in his hand, he could have drawn what he wanted to tell you.
Absolutely.
But talking to him was frustrating as hell. Roz always said that she was the Kirby translator for the planet Earth. Because people would say things to Jack, and then Roz would translate what was just asked, and then Kirby would say something baffling, and then Roz would translate that to the person asking the question. Because he really did just... He talked in circles. I don't know if you ever spoke to him. Like, ask me a question, I will answer it in the Kirby form. Ask a simple question.
What did you do today?
What I did today was that people have things that they must do every day. And today, I had a set of things to do with those things I did. And once I have done them, they have been done.
Yes.
If you ever talk to him, that's what he sounds like. He would just, he would catch a word and then he would run through it. Have you ever seen Trump at a press conference? He does the same kind of thing. And I'm not picking on Jack.
They're not the same people.
No, they're not the same. They're not the same people. Kirby only invented Dark Side. Trump is Dark Side. But the idea was, I got this feeling from him because language was so almost irrelevant to him that he was this weird savant that had this ability to speak visual language better than anybody ever born or ever would be born. But that the normal verbal language became this thing like, yeah, I could do that, but why bother?
I love the fact, by the way, just you mentioned Roz. I love the fact that Roz was his intermediary between, you know, Jack and the world.
Roz being Jack's wife, by the way.
Jack's wife, Roz, if you didn't know.
It allowed Jack to stay in his world and create, and it protected him. And, you know, he needed that. He was a very special person. He really needed that kind of insulation. And Roz was very, I would say, beneficial, critical to his career.
Okay, so Michael and I are going to talk about Ditko now. So this is what it is.
Okay.
There were two, back in, especially in the early 80s, and I don't know if you guys were the same way in the 70s, there were almost two camps at the time. There was the Jack Kirby camp and the Steve Ditko camp. And I, and you can trace this back to the type of individual you were, the type of exposure you had, the social networking you did. I was very much in the Steve Ditko camp. Part of that might have been influenced by some of the politics of the time where, you know, the Jack Kirby crusade to get his art back and to get credits. At the time, I drank the Kool-Aid, the Marvel Kool-Aid of, oh, Stan Lee is the man. He's the Marvel man. So who is this Jack Kirby guy who, to your point, Klaus, I did not like near as much as Steve Ditko. To me, I wouldn't say I was a loner, but back in the day, we moved a lot, so I didn't have a lot of huge groups of friends. I would build very intimate one-on-one relationships. And to me, that's the difference between a Jack Kirby and a Steve Ditko story, right? Jack Kirby always, and you see it throughout his history, he's got all these team books, right? It's always the interdynamics between groups of people. Whereas with Steve Ditko, it was very much internal and very much, it was Doctor Strange stuck with one foot in the real world and stuck with one foot in the metaphysical world, and no one, you know, he was by himself because they were all on their own side. Same thing, obviously, with Peter Parker. That was very attractive to me. And to your point, Klaus, the way Ditko created that, supported that with his visual language in terms of huge use of shadow, right? Borrowing from Will Eisner and Mort Meskin, artists like that, the use of shadow and the way to frame a sullen character by himself, just trying to exist in an irrational world, even before he got into the Ayn Rand philosophy type books. That really appealed to me, and I just love the style. I love the cheekbones. I love everything else that Kirby was doing at that time specifically was all seemed very square and very flat in terms of, you know, how he looked. Because I grew up on, I was part of that John Byrne, Frank Miller generation of the realism, the realistic people. I wanted to see that, so. To me, Steve Ditko, that world that he created, that visual language that he created, much like Kirby, was really unique to the world for me. And I was sucked in by that to the point of where I was definitely in the Ditko camp. And of course, Ditko never got the recognition because he didn't want it as much. So Michael, your perception of Ditko from that side?
Yeah, well, I was never, I wasn't a huge fan of either work in the 80s, but I was far more prescient than these guys, because when I was 7 years old, I knew that Kirby was fabulous, and I knew Ditko was fabulous. I used to, you know, as a little kid, it's like instinctively, I used to, my grandmother would work in a hospital as a volunteer, and they had comic books, and she would swipe them for me, so I sometimes get...
from the sick and dying!
From the sick and dying. But it came to me, so it was, you know, it was pretty well.
Circle of life.
Yeah, and I remember getting the first Tales to Astonish in 1959, 1960, and seeing this, Jack Kirby had these giant monsters, and they looked like they were about 5,000 feet tall. He had such a sense of scale. Whereas in the back, they would have a Steve Ditko story, and what was always so neat to me about Ditko is that they were small stories about ordinary people, schlubs, this and that here. Kirby's is always larger than life, and Ditko's was smaller than life. I loved them almost as much together, but Ditko finally won out. I was about 13 or something. I spent a lot of time. It was a really boring day. I was like, who do I like better, Kirby or Ditko? Who do I like better, Kirby or Ditko?
The identity crisis.
You're
right.
I finally went with Ditko, but they're both fabulous.
There was camps, apparently.
Yes.
Social networks built around these camps. I kind of always loved both of them because, for me, Ground Zero for Marvel Comics, as much as I love Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and all of that stuff, for me, Ground Zero is the monster books, the ones you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
The Tales of Suspense and
Strange Tales.
Strange Tales and that kind of thing. And to me, the glory of these books are you get a thing in the front called, you know, Wahuma, the beast that walks like a dude, and then in the back would be some Steve Ditko story where he would beat up and rob a gypsy and then discover that the gypsy had real powers.
Right.
I pretty well described every issue of Tales of Suspense. And I would just glory in both of them because I wanted to see Wahuma beat the crap out of the army, and then I wanted to see that little gypsy fortune teller getting killed.
Right.
And the combination of the two made those books treasures. Because it was, to me, it was the palette changing in the middle
mm-hmm.
of the thing. And then there was a Don Heck story you didn't read.
You live with
poor Don.
And here's the thing, Don Heck was a lovely man, and I was just an asshole to say that. Huh? You read those Don Heck stories? What happened to them? Were there gypsies or monsters? Then I didn't want to read them.
Don Heck in the mid-50s and the early 50s was a very good artist and just tried to get sandwiched into that Kirby Marvel House style
it
and
it really
didn't
was.
Work.
You got
didn't
a 10
well.
And a 10 and then a good solid 7. The man was a standing double. That's what he was.
So when you think about the MCU from the film side now of the last 10 years that my son and sounds like our children and a lot of people here would be most associated with that, what do you think from Stan, Jack, and Steve, what do you think translated, what do you think survived, the essence of their original books, what in particular do you think survived that surprises you or that most people wouldn't necessarily identify with?
All of it, the feel of it. Marvel movies feel like Marvel comics. The thing that amazes me is that they don't, the people that make the Marvel movies don't feel they have to fix a broken toy. The people that make the DC movies are clearly embarrassed by the characters and feel they have to fix them. And when I go to the movies, I go, don't fix them. They're fine. But the Marvel movies are made by people who go, I like these toys. I would like to take them and keep them intact. And I think the spirit of, I mean, people pick on Stan because he's a rapacious criminal, but he was...
Allegedly.
Yeah, allegedly. But he was this joke...
He can't sue me, he's dead.
First of all, he wasn't that bad.
I've got a good Stan Lee story that will prove he's not that bad either, so we'll swap that in towards
he's
the
not end. That bad. I am being glib. He wasn't rapacious. The
but he wasn't.
No, he didn't steal things from people.
Right.
We could get into the
moving forward to the MCU
also,
and then.
But
so.
No, that's true. But all of us on this dais stole from Kirby and Ditko.
That's true,
right?
Yeah.
So, you know.
I had a conversation about this with a friend of mine who writes for Marvel, and I said that at some point we all just make fan fiction. Because if you didn't create, you know, Iron Man and you're writing Iron Man right now, you're just doing fan fiction and getting paid for it. And he looked at me and goes, you've written Batman for 15 years. So get off the high horse. And I went, I paid the rent, you know. It somehow is not as bad with Batman.
You are in the middle of a story. Rapacious criminal. Stan, Steve, Dick, something. Yeah.
We're talking about what survived. So let's go.
What survived is his tone of voice, the voice, the sound. Because there was a tone to Stan's voice that when you were reading a Marvel comic, it was not like a story, it was like a clubhouse that you got to be a part of. And that very much it was the secret club, and that you knew how to say Excelsior when you met another Marvel fan, and we all got to giggle that nobody knew what that meant. And it means wood shavings is what it means. And that translated really well to the movies because they felt like the same secret club. They felt like you, if you knew these characters, they were getting it right. And I think that's why they translated really well. I think we all watched the Iron Man movie and he stepped out of the cave inside that original Iron Man costume. We all went, damn, that's what it should look like. You didn't feel you needed to fix that. You just told that story.
Well,
I think one of the things, Michael, go.
Oh, I was about to say that one of the things that I think works so well with the Marvel movies is because the source material had a core of emotional truth. And when I was looking at the Doctor Strange, the thing that Stan and Steve did, he had this doctor who was just an arrogant jerk, and he gets this accident, and he has to learn how to be unselfish in order to save and grow. And they captured that in the movie. When you had Iron Man, you know, he had the fatal flaw of his heart, and he had to overcome that in order to live. And they captured that. They changed the details.
Physically and figuratively, right, about his heart.
Yeah.
Right, not just the physical part of his heart, but proof that Tony Stark has a heart, right?
Right.
I always love the idea that when I read, I think in Son of Origins or Origins, that Stan decided to do Iron Man because he wanted to think of the most villainous character he could turn into a hero. And he thought, what about an arms manufacturer during the Vietnam War? You couldn't get someone the kids are more primed to dislike, a guy that makes weapons during a time when everybody's a peacenik. And that was the challenge. He wanted to. And when they made that movie, starts off with him demonstrating weapons in Afghanistan. They kept the heart of it absolutely intact. Here was a weapons manufacturer during a period of a bad war. And they didn't fix it. They didn't change it. They didn't make him a guy who owned a restaurant or something stupid. And that's why it worked.
Klaus, I'm gonna throw a curveball at you here, and I'm going to say that every single Spider... I agree with everything that was said about the voice of the MCU and the original comics, but I'm going to make the case, and you can come back here around that, they still haven't done a Steve Ditko Spider-Man movie yet.
Yeah.
They all seem very John Romita to me. He's just sort of this lovable, he's just sort of the lovable loser, the lovable, oops, I kind of bounce into trouble, and you know, this. But to me, what made the Steve Ditko Spider-Man narrative unique, and I think this is why it was almost exclusive to Ditko, was there was real pathos in that character. There was real depression and isolation in that character for really in the first time in the history of comics that when a character got superpowers, his life got dramatically worse instead of better. But there was that real angst, anxiety, pathos in that character, and that was the whole narrative arc to growing up to being that, you know, that Ayn Rand character in Spider-Man 33 pushes off. But I still haven't seen that yet. I think they captured all the other characters exceptionally well, but I still haven't seen a Steve Ditko Spider-Man movie yet. What are your thoughts?
I think you're right, Blake. I don't know if the world is ready for a Steve Ditko version of Spider-Man. What intrigues me about the Ditko Spider-Man is that it's such a reflection, I think, of Steve himself. That Steve was very introspective. He was very... he thought about things. He took life very seriously. He isolated himself, you know, deliberately so. He had morals and principles, and he lived by them. I think, and Blake, you know much more about this than I do, but, you know, there were times when I would see Steve up in the office in the 80s, and he would be working on ROM, I had the pleasure of inking him a few times on a Daredevil. But, you know, he walked around with tape on his shoes to hold his shoes together. And I thought, this is a guy who is living his beliefs. And he believed what he believed in, and he didn't waver. And I really admired that. And I don't, you know, one of the things that I really liked about the Marvel movies is that they are funny. DC movies are just not funny. And because they're not funny, they're not entertaining. So Marvel movies have the ability to be funny, and Spider-Man, Tom Holland is terrific, but the movies are funny. You know, they're entertaining, and they're light, and they're funny, and they're not what Steve Ditko was trying to do. You don't see too much introspection, you know, in the Tom Holland version of Spider-Man. Andrew Garfield was... a little bit closer to Ditko, there was more tragedy in Andrew Garfield than there is in Tom Holland.
I've forgotten those two. I think my son. Yeah. They've been a bit of a wash out in the mines right
poor
now.
Poor Andrew.
I thought that the Tobey Maguire ones were the first three, the first two and a half. When they started feeling they had to squeeze Venom into the third one, I thought they lost it. But I thought the first two were very Ditko-esque myself. Not, maybe not as depressing as you're talking about here, but...
Well, it's ironic, because Ditko, yeah, he could be very introspective and depressed, but he had, there was a sense of humor. There was a... He could... His characters, even a Peter Parker, could find part of it, I'm sure, was Stan's influence, but he could find the humor in those dark situations. That's what the tension of those books worked well, was the solemn Peter Parker, and then magically he's able to let it all go when he's flying around in his underwear and doing ballet on these webs.
It's a lot like, if I may, the collaboration between Lennon and McCartney, in that if you take those two apart, Lennon was very pessimistic and saw the world as a dark and horrible place, and McCartney just thought everything was great. And between the two, you get songs that have lyrics in it like, it's getting better all the time because it can't get no worse. And lines like that have that salt and pepper in it. And to me, that's what Ditko and Lee were doing. Because Ditko was creating this morose, introspective, somewhat painfully depressed character. And Stan was still having him, you know, say goofy, fun things. And so we had that leavening agent. Otherwise, it would have been too much one way. And the same happened with the collaborations with Stan and Jack, which was that Jack had these insane ideas that he couldn't translate into English, and Stan could make them at least something palatable that we could read. So that no matter what the hell was happening in Thor, Stan could put dialogue to them and make it make sense. And I believe that the collaborations here are some of the truest collaborations we get in the business, because Stan, without Jack or Steve, hasn't done much. And Steve and Jack, without Stan, didn't do as glorious a work. So I would argue that they were not necessarily happy to collaborate with each other, because they bristled at the changes they made. But I don't think we would come to appreciate them as much as if Ditko didn't have Stan writing dialogue for him, and if Jack didn't have Stan writing dialogue for him. I think that not so much rescued them, but made them commercial enough to be successful.
So we have...
not 15, patient's criminal, though.
We have about 15 minutes to go, so we're going to share some stories that we had meeting some of these individuals. So I promised the Stan Lee story, right? So I met Stan through, again, that first book that I ever wrote, The I Have to Live with This Guy, because I wanted to interview his spouse, Joni, about what it was like to live with Stan Lee during that time. And it was the same with Will Eisner and the same with the Q-Birds, where their spouses knew virtually nothing about the time that we wanted to hear all these stories, right? Because these were successful businessmen who went more into the business side of comics versus the Gene Colans, who were all just about writing and drawing. And so they went to work at 9 o'clock, came home at 5 o'clock, and it was very different than Adrian Colan talking about how the struggles with Jim Shooter and all these struggles to pump out all this artwork. But... you know, for all the stories of Stan and, you know, and the stories about how, you know, he took credit for X, Y, and Z, he was extremely good to me. They were doing another book that he was sharing some of his pictures and things at that time, and he went through great efforts to make sure that I had all the materials. This is 2002, sorry. He went to great lengths to give me a lot of his time, but also package up a lot of his materials for my book. And even better, when I was doing the Steve Ditko book in 2008, preparing that 2007, I could just call him up randomly and just ask him questions about, at the time, it was still a very tender subject for him, the relationship between Steve Ditko and Stan Lee, because they had broken up very early on in the mid-60s, and Steve was poking him more and more in the late 90s and the 2000s, because, you know, the internet was coming out, social media, so Stan was getting the headlines again and as the Marvel movies, and he would say, oh, I was the creator of this, and then Steve would write a letter to Time magazine saying, well, what about me? You know, you weren't even writing those books when Spider-Man 33 and the famous machinery that we saw in the Tom Holland movie, you and I weren't even talking for that last year of Spider-Man, so what are you doing? But if I had a question on Ditko, I actually called Stan up and I said, so your impressions, because we were all trying to discover how Ditko discovered Ayn Rand, who was a philosopher, objectivist philosopher in the 50s and 60s, wrote The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, which, as Klaus said, Ditko lived that, right? He walked away from all the Marvel books in the mid-60s, and by the early 80s, the 20th anniversary, as they were celebrating 20 years and all the success, Ditko was really down in the dumps because he wouldn't take projects that he didn't believe in. So when I said to Stan, like, where did this Ayn Rand thing come along? He said, I was a big Ayn Rand fan back in the early 60s. And I was the one who said, Steve, take a look at these books. And I was just like shocked and blown away. But that's where the origin. So he always did well by me. And when we were at the San Diego Comic Con in 2002, I was there with Dennis Kitchen and Batten Lash. God rest his soul, Batten Lash, who passed away as well in the last year. And we saw Stan and some Hollywood bigwig whose name I'm forgetting now. They were sitting at a table, and they were like, "Yeah, you just got that your book published. Go over talking." So I went over to Stan, and I said, "Hey, Stan, I'm Blake Bell." And he turned to his movie executive friend. He goes, "Oh, this is Blake Bell. He just came up with the most amazing idea for a book. He interviewed all the wives and cartoons. Come, sit down. Come, let's talk." So I got pictures of me talking. And he was always a lovely gentleman. I mean, there's lovely dictators in the world and things of that nature, too, who do terrible things and who make choices in times that they don't. But I can say without unassurance that he was very helpful, very kind and warm, and loving to me. And I would say the same about Ditko. I met Ditko at a studio a couple times, and he gave me the time. I was doing his website in 2001, and even though things came to a head over an article that I'd written in Comic Book Artist, he forgave me for that, and we still had some conversations after that. I took him up at 2008 when my book was published. I took the book to his studio because he said it was going to be a poison sandwich, and he wasn't a fan of Gary Groth, the publisher of Fantagraphics at that time. And so I took the book up to his studio because I said, "Well, do you want to actually..." So I knocked on the door, 2008, and he shows up again, sweat. It's one of those old 1950s dress shirts, thin as a... And he opened the door up, and he just looked at my son and I, who would have been 10 years old, and he just went, "Oh." And so another fan, because now with all the Spider-Man movies and everything, people were coming harassing. And so I said, "Hey, Stan, Steve, Blake Bell," because I met him in 2001 in the same studio. And I said, "Hey, I just wanted to know if you wanted to see the book, because you called it a poison sandwich, just sight unseen. Do you want to actually go on the facts?" And he was like, "No, it's too late for that now." And I was like, "Oh, wait a minute. There was a moment that it wasn't too late for you to be a part of this book." And we had, again, a genial conversation. But then at the end, he was about to close the door, and he turns to my son and goes, "Well, it was nice meeting you." And he shut the door in my face. So God bless him. But again, any interactions that I had, the letters that we exchanged back when I was doing the site, it wasn't some lunatic who was some total recluse who just was deranged or painted the way that, just because he didn't want fame and fortune and wouldn't do interviews because he wanted to work speak for itself. Don't paint him as that type of picture, for who knows what goes on behind closed doors. But both gentlemen is where I'm going, because I never met Jack. Both gentlemen were always very cordial and nice to myself. Do you guys have any other stories you want to share with meeting Jack or Stan? Or?
First thing, just after you left the table, Stan told everybody he wrote your book.
First time I met Jack Kirby, I was in San Diego. I'd come down to San Diego because I was drawing a book for DC Comics, and one of my editors said, "Hey, you're about to judge a costume contest." I went, "Fabulous." They sit me down next to Jack, so I'm to the left of him, basically where you're sitting right now. And I wanted to talk to him. This is a legend. And so the first time somebody came out in a Jack Kirby costume, it was somebody dressed as Hela, goddess of death from Thor. And if you've never seen her costume, it's basically hockey sticks glued to your head. It's just gigantic 9-foot piles of wood coming off your head. And I thought this poor woman was going to snap her neck for the 80-pound hat that she was wearing. And I turned to Jack and went, "If this woman dies, it's your fault. Because you designed that headgear." Nothing. Doesn't even look at me. Get no reaction whatsoever. Couple of minutes later, somebody comes out dressed as Galactus, and they also have the giant hockey stick headgear that's on, but this thing has a garbage can wedded to the hockey stick, so it's a much bigger, dangerous neck-snapping event. And I do the same thing, and I go, you're going to kill two fans today, Jack. Nothing. And a couple of minutes later, a woman comes out dressed as Red Sonja, and if you've ever seen her costume, it's basically a bikini made out of quarters. And the woman wearing the outfit deserved to wear the outfit, and I haven't gotten anything from Jack, so it didn't even occur to me. And at this point, he elbows me and goes, "She wins." I love that the very first thing he ever said to me was a dirty old man joke. She didn't win, by the way. It was actually somebody else completely. But I just love the fact that he clearly understood I was trying to relate to him.
Right.
And anyone, I think I know what this guy was. He's on stage, and we're both happy. So I got to meet Jack through his dirty old man animus area.
I was lucky enough to be at Marvel when Stan was just sort of peaking, and Roy was taking over, and he was still hanging around. So, you know, there were a lot of occasions when I ran into Stan, and, you know, and each time was memorable. But I don't know if you know this about Stan, but Stan had an enormous ego.
Unlike most artists.
I adored that Marvel.
I hope that doesn't come as a surprise to you. But there were times when Stan, and this cracks me up just thinking, there were times when Stan, you know, there were rough days, and you know, books weren't on time, you know, people were, you know, terrible to him, and you know, there was always problems. What he would do when he needed a lift was he would go downstairs. This was on Madison Avenue. This was in the old Vision building, and he would go downstairs, and he would stand on the corner, lean up against the fire hydrant, one leg up, one leg down, and he would wait until someone recognized him. And when he got that, he would come back upstairs and everything would be fine. And we would know, oh, he did the fire hydrant thing.
Great stuff.
That's
so unlike him.
Loved it.
I got a practical joke I played on Stan once.
Go for it.
Years ago in San Diego, a group of people went to the San Diego Zoo, at Marineland Zoo thing. It's basically a lot of captive animals in one place. And every time you go to one of the little exhibits, there's somebody feeding seals fish or something, and there's a person with a microphone explaining how seals eat fish, and they're giving a talk to the group. And in our group was myself, Mark Wade, we're the two troublemakers in the group, Stan Lee, John Byrne, and a guy named Robert Lauren Fleming, and it's important to the story, who used to write Aquaman for DC Comics. And so at every single booth, every place that there was an animal act, we would say, excuse me, we're traveling with a celebrity, Mr. Stan Lee is with us, and I would like you to introduce him to the audience if you could. So at every single person, they go, you know, before we start the dolphin show, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Stan Lee is here, and then we get a nice round of applause. And by the third or fourth place that we'd gone to, Stan was going, stop that. Stop doing this. I just don't want to have this keep happening. But Mark and I were like in our 20s, and we were jerks, so we kept doing it. And every place we went, it became this moment of, before we feed the dolphins, ladies and gentlemen, Stan Lee. So at the end of the day, we go see the Shamu Show. Now, the Shamu Show is an amphitheater that holds about 1,500 people. And Wade and I made a point of getting up to the top where we found the person who was announcing the Shamu Show for the entire 1,500 people. And we gave them the special message. And we went back down to our seats. And it was, ladies and gentlemen, before the Shamu Show begins, we have a celebrity in our audience. And Stan starts to stand up. The guy announces, Robert Lauren Fleming, author of Aquaman. Stan, literally, standing up to wave, sits down. I am deeply proud that Mark and I pulled that stunt on stage.
Okay, well, with that, guys, well, let's close on a high note here. I just want to thank, first of all, I want to thank all of you for coming out. By the way, if you're interested in any early Steve Ditko work or Bill Everett work, who did a lot of work with Stan Lee, I've got some of my books here on sale. They're half price. They're $20 a shot. The gentleman in the Toronto Maple Leafs jersey there, you're more than welcome to afford you that. But thank you all for coming here. It was great to have you here. And it was especially great to have these three lovely participants who tolerated me. Michael T. Gilbert, Ty Templeton, Paul Jackson. Thank you all for coming and have a great rest of the show, guys.